The victor on this occasion was a sorry sight. He was left battered and limping, and he walked as if he was a century old for the next day or two. Another challenger would have finished him, but none came, and he nursed himself back to strength. It took Brownie and me about 3 weeks to gather the different family groups. When we were 5 miles from the trap in the Barranca with one group, a team of 6 day hands from the Campbell Ranch would ride out, circle the mustangs, and help drive them into the enclosures where a feed of alfalfa awaited them. They would then tell me where the second group had been last sighted, and take Brownie, Oriole, and me in the van as close as dirt roads would allow, maybe 15 to 20 miles. When they left us and were driving back, they'd drop a trail of alfalfa every mile or two back to the trap, as bait for the horses. At the end of the 3 week period, we had about 500 mustangs corralled. We culled lactating mares, obviously pregnant fillies, breeding stallions, and older animals, then loaded about 100 young colts and fillies into the trucks and drove them back to Salinas as before. That year they had a much better wild horse race. The horses were suitable for the task at hand, and fewer were injured. Once again I watched from the grandstand, but took no pleasure in it. I vowed to train myself as quickly as possible to communicate with horses. I was beginning to realize that there was a lot of apologizing to be done to the equine species. Euphoric from my time in the desert and bursting with what I thought were critical insights about horses, I looked forward to telling my mother and brother about my discoveries. My mother was a quiet, competent rider who genuinely liked her horses, and she was naturally intrigued by my tales. But the one person who understood better than anyone my sense of excitement, if not precisely what I was saying, was Bill Dorrance, who had helped me connect with the Campbell Ranch. Bill was born in 1903. He was a slim six-footer and always wore round glasses. Were you to see him in a three-piece suit and hear him talk, you might take the straight, stiff man for a banker or an accountant, certainly an educated man. In fact, like his brother Tom, he had little formal schooling, but there was a remarkable brightness about them both. Now in his mid-90s, Bill is still a fine rider and roper, but as a young man he was nervous when he competed under pressure in the show ring. Bill Dorrance was all about careful calculation. In terms of the psychology of a horse, the study of the horse's mind, he was light years ahead of his time. He was the only one who believed in me. And when I was 17, my father finally forbade me to see him. "Bill Dorrance will destroy you," he predicted one memorable day in Salinas. Bill was a progressive man with new ideas, ideas I shared and understood. When I got back from the desert, I went right to him. He was like a grandfather to me, an armchair philosopher of horsemanship. He was ridiculed for some of the things he said, but I now see how far ahead of his time he really was. "You have to cause your horse to be mellow," he once told me, "to be in unison with you, not against you." It was a breathtaking notion for someone of his generation. I owe Bill a great deal. What we shared was a keen awareness of the possibilities between horses and humans, a sense that we had barely scratched the surface of that ancient connection. "I'm discovering things about horses," he once told me, "and I don't want to die before I pass them on. You're young and talented, and I want to pass them on to you." I felt I did possess a special affinity with horses. Now that I was beginning to understand their silent language, I could turn a great corner. My ambition was immense. Change the way humans relate to horses. The 100 Mustangs at the competition grounds would be the ideal test of my theory. How to form a natural bond with a wild horse. How to convince the horse you're an ally, not a predator. How to cast myself as the dominant matriarch and speak her language. I'd have to work fast and with one eye on the whereabouts of my father, because I didn't want him to interfere, although underneath it all, I still sought his acceptance and approval. As it happened, in the course of starting the Mustangs, I discovered something so exciting that I began to believe I could persuade even my tradition-bound father to see things my way. I had identified a phenomenon that I called join-up. As I lay in bed at night, I could hardly sleep, So convinced was I that I had stumbled on something that truly would change the way we operate with horses. Surely, I reasoned, my father would see it. He was too experienced a horseman not to. But I knew better than to go to him and show him directly. Instead, I settled on showing Ray Hackworth, hoping that he could prevail upon my father because he had my father's respect. Ray Hackworth leased facilities at the competition grounds where we lived. Soft-spoken, but also a disciplinarian, he was a noted trainer and a gentleman. I asked him to come and watch what I could do. I told him I had discovered a phenomenon that I could explain only in terms of the horse's own language. I promised him that I could dissolve the natural barrier between horse and man, flight animal and fight animal. He reminded me that my father had often warned me over the years that my ideas could be dangerous and I should stick to the conventional ways of doing things. But I continued to implore him to come and see for himself what I could do. If I could please Ray, I could surely please my father. Eventually, he agreed. When we arrived at the round pen, Ray strolled up the ramp onto the viewing deck and leaned against the fence. "Okay," he said, tipping his hat to the back of his head. "Let's see it." I stood in the middle of the pen, together with a 3-year-old colt not long past the trauma of the wild horse race. The colt wore no halter, rope, or restraint of any type. The door to the round pen was closed. It was he and I. From practicing this 100 times over, I knew what to do. I confidently waited a moment or two to let this unnamed Mustang get accustomed to the round pen. He was too nervous to take a single step toward me, although his attention was on me as the main threat currently confronting him. "What I'm gonna do," I said, "is use the same language as the dominant mare in his family group." The silence from the viewing deck told me Ray wasn't going to ask questions, so I continued. "That language is a silent language, a body language. And the first thing I'm going to ask him is to go away from me, to flee. I'm only doing this because then I'll ask him to come back and join up with me." I moved quite abruptly toward the colt. I squared my shoulders and fixed my eye on his eye. Straight away he went into flight, taking off in a canter around the perimeter, staying as close to the wall as he could and as far from me as possible. I continued to press him into flight, in the same way I'd observed the matriarch driving away the adolescents in the wild. I remained square on to him. I maintained direct eye contact. For Ray's benefit, I continued to explain what I was doing. "In his own language, I'm saying to him, go ahead and flee. But I don't want you to go away a little. I want you to go away a lot. For now, I'll call the shots until we can form a partnership. You see, I speak your language." I had a light sash line, and I pitched it at the colt, not to hit him, but to encourage him to flee, which he did. As he cantered around the pen, I used the line and my body posture to keep him in flight. My shoulders were parallel to his long axis. I was facing directly toward his head, and with my body pressing him away. My eyes were locked on his. This continued for several minutes. I was watching for the signals, the same signals I had observed in the wild, when the adolescents would ask the dominant mare to be released from their enforced exile. Meanwhile, as a test, I allowed my eyes to drop back to his neck. When I did, he slowed. I let my eyes drop back farther to his shoulder, and he slowed a bit more. His head started to come off the rail a bit to look over at me. When I let my eyes drop back to his hip, I saw a further reduction in speed, and he began to angle off the wall even more. Then I took my eyes back to his eyes, and his speed increased immediately. He moved back toward the wall and was in full flight again. He was reading me. He knew we were dealing with each other in his language. I called to Ray. "I'm waiting for his ear to open onto me, for him to start licking and chewing, and then for him to duck his head and run along holding it a few inches off the ground." It was important that Ray realize I could predict what would happen. "Here's the first one now," I called. "See?" The colt's inside ear had opened toward me and stayed fixed in that position. The outside ear was tuned to the surrounding areas, flicking forward and back. The colt was saying, I don't really know what this is all about, but I'll pay attention to you and we'll see where it goes from here." The colt had made approximately 8 revolutions of the round pen before the ear closest to me was adequately locked on. At this point, I pitched the line in front of the colt and stepped a bit to the front of his action, keeping my eyes locked on his to prevent his coming off the wall toward me. Quickly, he reversed field and fled in the opposite direction. In a moment or two, the ear closest to me was locked on to me as before. It was going according to pattern. Since Ray couldn't know what to look for down in that pen between the kid and the colt, it was important that I explain my actions and expectations. But I suddenly sensed this might all be a mistake. A 14-year-old explaining things to an older man? It might be seen as arrogant. Still, I hoped, the value of what I was doing would counteract that. I began to take the pressure off the colt. First, I reduced the number of times I cast the line at him. Then I coiled the line and held it in my hand, slapping my leg with it to encourage him to continue. The colt came back to a trot. By this time, he had made 12 revolutions of the round pen. The next signal came right on time. He started to lick and chew. His tongue actually came through his teeth and outside his mouth. Then he pulled his tongue back and chewed with his teeth. There was a ripple effect across the large mandibles. "There!" I called to Ray. "You see that chewing action with his mouth? That's exactly what I saw them doing out on the range. It means he's ready to discuss this situation. He's gone away, and I've pressed him away farther. He's recognized my desire to communicate with him, and now he'd like the chance to renegotiate. This licking and chewing action of the colt is a message to me. It's saying something like, 'I'm a herbivore, I'm a grazer, and I'm making this eating action with my mouth now because I'm considering whether or not to trust you. Help me out with that decision, can you please?'" Then came the final signal I was looking for. As the colt trotted around, he dropped his head so his nose was traveling only an inch or so above ground level. "And there you go," I called to Ray. "His head's dropped. I can't tell you the times I've seen this out there in the desert, and it always means the same thing. It means, 'Let me back in. I don't want to flee anymore.'" It was time for me, like the dun mare, to turn passive, to let this colt come and join up with me. I allowed my eyes to travel to a point maybe 15 to 20 feet in front of him. I moved my shoulders around to follow my eyes until they were on a 45-degree angle to his long body axis. I was avoiding eye contact and showing him my flanks, as it were. Immediately he stopped. He came off the wall and faced me. I maintained my position, my body and my eye line at 45 degrees to his. He took a step or two toward me. I waited. Then he walked right up to me, not stopping until his nose was inches from my shoulder. I couldn't speak. I wanted to shout to Ray, "Look, this is what I mean. How about this? Isn't it fantastic?" But I couldn't afford to break the spell. It was indeed magic. This colt trusted me. No longer a predator, I was his safety zone. The moment of acceptance or join-up is what I had discovered, and I felt a shudder of heartfelt emotion. I felt the same thrill with every one of the 10,000 or more horses I've started this way. I fervently hoped that Ray felt the same way. To test the strength of the join-up, I took a slow right turn. The colt followed me into the circle, his nose to my shoulder. Then I took a left turn. He hesitated and looked to be going the other way. Immediately I knew to return to a dominant stance, and I began to drive him away. He didn't like that. And before he had completed one circuit of the round pen, he was flicking his nose out and apologizing, asking to be let back in. I allowed him back, soothed him and talked to him, and gave him a good stroke between the eyes. It's not essential to use the area between the eyes as the stroking point, but it seems to be more effective to touch the horse here than any other part of the body. There's a general consensus that for a horse to let you into a part of his anatomy that he cannot see is the ultimate expression of trust. Now I had the colt walking comfortably behind me, and I knew Ray would be amazed. I imagined him saying to my father, I tell you, Marvin, that boy of yours had a wild horse walking along behind him like it was his best friend after only 25 minutes. He's on to something. Come down and see for yourself. I called out to Ray as quietly as possible now that the colt was standing next to me. Ray, you know, now that he's joined up with me and we're on the same side, it's pretty much of a formality. When I was confident the colt fully trusted me, I brought in another long line, a saddle, bridle, and a saddle pad, as well as a long stirrup leather, all of which I put on the ground in the middle of the pen. With the click of the gate, the colt's stance changed. He saw something different, a pile of equipment, and became frightened. He had justification for being skeptical, so I waited. I allowed him to choose between me and the equipment. He chose me and calmed down. He stood still while I carefully lifted the saddle pad and the saddle onto his back. He let me fix the girth, slowly, smoothly. After taking a step or two away, he steadied and let me continue. Before any rope or lead had been attached to his head, let alone a bridle, he was wearing his first saddle. He was asking me lots of questions, his ears flicking back and forth and his nostrils blowing, but he trusted me. At this point, I stepped away from him and squared up to him, driving him away, not aggressively, but with the confidence I had developed over the last 200 or so horses. He went into flight and began to canter around the perimeter of the round pen. I wanted to familiarize him with the saddle before a rider was on. He bucked hard for several minutes, which I was glad to see because I didn't want Hackworth to think this was a fluke. Within a few minutes, the colt was cantering steadily around, the bucking over. I saw the same signals, the licking and chewing, the inside ear settling on me, his coming off the wall to get closer to me. For a minute or two, I worked him around the outer limits of the pen and let him find comfort in carrying the saddle, first one way, then the other. After 3 or 4 revolutions in each direction, the colt was telling me he was ready to come back in. I let him join up with me, adjusted his girth, and generally soothed him with my voice. He was doing fine. There was nothing to be frightened about if he stuck with me. I'd look after him and have fun with him, love him like I loved all his brothers and sisters. I took the bridle and lifted it over his ears. The colt accepted the snaffle with no more than a brief lift of his head. I secured the reins under the rear portion of the saddle and took the stirrups down to prepare for long lining. Then I sent the colt back to work, cantering him around the perimeter, first one way, then the other. He was fully tacked up, wearing a saddle and a bridle in the long lines. I called out, "I want to gain his confidence and make him happy to follow the bit and bridle, as he'll be doing just that for the rest of his working life. I want to make it a happy experience for him." I turned the colt 6 or 7 times before stopping him and reining back one step. I again adjusted his girth. I brushed the saddle with my hands, rubbed his neck and belly. Then I put my left toe in the stirrup and prepared to lift myself onto his back. I felt the strain in my thigh muscle as I asked the colt if I could put my full weight into the stirrup, testing for his reaction. He took a sideways step to help redistribute the extra weight, but he held firm. I lifted myself up. Instead of swinging a leg over, I lay across his back for a while, waiting to see if he was comfortable with this. I hoped I was answering any questions he had with the things I was saying to him. I'd find him a good name. We'd find him a good home. Perhaps he'd enjoy being a ranch horse, or maybe he'd go into a Western show in the pleasure horse category. He might end up with a kid like me, learning to ride. I let the colt catch sight of me out of both eyes before calmly swinging a leg over and sitting up. I was riding him after only 40 minutes. I sat there jubilant on the back of that horse. An idealistic youth, I was convinced that it was only a matter of weeks before I'd enjoy the respect and admiration of my elders and betters all over the county, and especially my father. "That was a fluke!" Ray barked out. He was staring at me, a concerned look on his face. The sound of his voice coincided with the colt's first steps, and I didn't try to stop him. As the colt and I walked around together, I heard Ray say, "You're wrong to go against your father. He's worried about you getting hurt, and you could be hurt. These horses are dangerous. I suggest you stop it now." He walked from the viewing deck and disappeared from sight. I rode the colt, feeling crushed at the very moment I should have felt triumphant. The people whose respect and guidance I needed were refusing to give it. I vowed never to mention my ideas to anyone again. Chapter 2. Growing Up with Horses. My first and most vivid childhood memory has me on the back of a horse. The ears of a horse flicking back and forth, the neck bobbing in front of me, the mane bouncing as the horse's rhythmic stride carried us along. Well before I could walk, horse geography was as familiar to me as the human kind. I wasn't like other toddlers, lifted onto a saddle as a diversion or so that a photograph might be snapped. I sat on a horse in the crook of my mother's arm for many hours at a time, while she gave riding lessons at the horse facility where she and my father lived. The smell of leather reins and horsehair, the sound of a horse blowing, the smell of fresh hay and horse lather, my senses first stirred in the world of horses. I was born in the midst of the Great Depression, on May 14, 1935, in the little town of Salinas, 100 miles south of San Francisco. John Steinbeck grew up in Salinas and set many of his classic novels, The Grapes of Wrath, East of Eden, The Red Pony, in this region. Perhaps he drew inspiration for his characters from my ancestors, among the immigrants and natives who came to settle in Edenic, California. The first thing I would have seen when I was carried outside our little gray house would have been 2,300 acres of prime land situated in the so-called Salad Bowl of America. I remember the smells of the valley. The awful, sweet, fermenting smells from Spreckles, the big sugar plant. The pungent hothouse smells of broccoli, onion, garlic, and the other cash crops growing in the alluvial topsoil that was 20 feet deep in places. In East of Eden, Steinbeck talks about the Salinas River Valley, how the river raged in spring, then went underground in summer. A part-time river, he called it. The novel describes how a man bored a well in that lush valley, and up came white sand full of shells and pieces of whalebone, along with bits of redwood, proof that the valley had once been a forest, and later an inland sea. Steinbeck sketches the flowers that grow there, the California poppies, the color of gold. If pure gold were liquid and could raise a cream. The blue lupins, the buttercups, the stands of Indian paintbrush, the yellow violets with black centers. He describes the valley's yellow mustard, once so tall that if a man were to ride a horse in a field of it, only his head would be visible. The valley is prone to extremes. Occasionally too much water in winter, too little in summer. Topsoil thick in the valley bottom, scant on the mountain sides. Spring grasses were luxurious, but in summer the hot wind, a rasping, nervous wind, Steinbeck called it, forced men working in the fields to wear goggles over their eyes and kerchiefs over their noses to keep out the dust. And Steinbeck refers to the place names, like Wild Horse Canyon and Mustang Grade, a reminder for me of how horses figure prominently in the valley and in my life. We didn't live in a rural setting. Our place was set on the edge of a town in a built-up area, but every one of our buildings was horse-inspired, from box stalls to a show ring with bleachers to enclosures and breeding barns. By the time I was 2, I spent most of the day on a horse, having graduated to a mount of my own. My childhood was unique. Few people can say they were born and raised on a rodeo competition grounds. The grounds came to exist when Eugene Sherwood died and willed to the city of Salinas 2,300 acres to be used solely for horse-related activities. When the estate in the city called on my father to manage the land, he agreed, and shortly thereafter construction began on more than 800 box stalls and a competition area with a 20,000-seat grandstand. At the time, it was the largest equestrian facility in North America. It still exists, but was recently rebuilt. I plucked as a souvenir a slab of concrete from the old grandstand. In addition to managing the facility, my father, Marvin, also operated his own writing school on the grounds. Physical education classes in Salinas grammar and high schools offered horseback riding. And so every day my mother, Marguerite, would make her rounds in our big station wagon, picking up students and bringing them to the grounds for their lessons, then returning them to class. Marvin Earl Roberts also trained and boarded horses for private clients and leased the facilities to various horse trainers, as stipulated by Eugene Sherwood in his will. My first horse was called Ginger. No one asked about his breeding. He was that kind of horse. Ginger was a red roan, with a bit of thoroughbred in him, some Spanish pony blood, and maybe some Belgian 4 generations back, judging by the bit of feather on his legs. He was 13 years old when I first met him, a reined cow horse from the Yule Ranch who in his time had been a fair entry in Western competition. Now, in his retirement, he was required to be both my babysitter and my teacher. Ginger had the perfect temperament, well-disciplined and steady, and marvelously calm, collected, and amiable. Bomb-proof, as horse people say. He had done all the cowboy stuff for years, and he knew it intimately. Even with a 3-year-old kid bouncing on his withers and flapping his arms and legs in every direction, Ginger was patient. He knew me and nickered for me. His was not a noble or a peaceful retirement, but I think he too had fun. In my eyes, he could do no wrong. I can remember people saying, "That boy's just 3 years old," but I could walk, trot, and canter a horse, do flying lead changes, and perform figure-of-eight maneuvers without a great deal of trouble. My father soon noticed my riding abilities and made plans to exploit them. Before I'd even started kindergarten, my father told me I had to practice harder and spend more time riding than I already did. He seized on me rather than my brother because Larry was younger and born with a condition that, during his early years, made him somewhat frail. Larry was a gifted rider, more gifted than I was. But where he needed looking after, I could be pushed to the limit. I entered horse shows regularly and competed almost every weekend. I still have some shaky old footage of Larry and me entering the junior stock horse class when I was 4 years old. The grainy, flickering film shows us running our horses around, spinning and stopping them and racing them back and forth like miniature versions of the cowboys who had taught us, all in eerie silence. When I see how I hauled Ginger around by his mouth and mistreated him, it makes me sad. I hope he understood that I was only a small child who knew no better. In the Salinas Junior Stock Horse Competition, most of the children were older, but I had Ginger on my side, and he knew how to score high marks in these events. He had been doing it for years against stiffer competition than this. The publicity that accrued from this unlikely win on Ginger had an intoxicating effect on my parents. Their business suddenly expanded. Mr. and Mrs. Roberts were plainly the best teachers because they had a boy of only 4 who won a trophy. It confirmed my father's belief. I was the child who would make the Roberts name famous in the world of show horses. My father was an important figure, both in my personal life and in my working life with horses. Everything I achieved came to me because of the early and concentrated exposure to horses that he gave me. But if my professional life can be described as having a direction, it's one that runs absolutely counter to my father and his thinking. Eventually, my stance against him and his methods amounted to outright rebellion, for which I paid dearly. My father died in 1986, but calling him up even now, all these years later, is a bitterly hard thing to do. To understand who I am and how I am with horses, you must understand who my father was and how he was with horses. My father was a tall man of a slim, muscular build with chiseled features and light brown hair. He was as neat and orderly as circumstances allowed. If he met a friend in Salinas, he could be friendly, even inviting. Later in life, he showed great tenderness to members of my family, but I never saw that side of him. I never shook hands with him, never got hugged by him. He would pass me on the street and not say hello. From the outset, he turned a cold and critical eye on me. Generous with others, he demanded perfection of me. He was unforgiving and scrutinized everything I did, more often than not holding it up to ridicule. As a boy, I was serious and polite, and when I look back on those times, I see that I never was a child. Child prodigy, perhaps. My father's protege, yes, for a time. But a child? Never. My father's methods of dealing with horses were what I would describe as conventional, but that is to say, cruel. The standard way of breaking horses in those days remains popular even today. A television program from 1989 celebrated 20 years of space travel and made the point that while outer space is the great frontier of our era, the Wild West was its previous counterpart. As the program noted, some things haven't changed since those times. Among their featured examples was how we break horses. My father had a special corral built with six solid posts fixed at equal distances around its perimeter. This way he could break half a dozen horses simultaneously. First he put halters on them. This might involve running horses through a squeeze chute to gain close enough access. Next he attached strong ropes to their halters and tied each horse to a post, wrapping the rope around the post about 6 feet off the ground and tying off the end on the rails. Imagine then, six animals tied 30 feet apart around the edge of the corral. The horses were already terrified, and the process had only just begun. Next, my father stood in the middle of the corral with a heavy tarpaulin or weighted sack attached to the end of a rope. He threw the sack over the horses' backs and around their legs, moving from one horse to the next. When the sack dropped on their hips and around their rear legs, the horses panicked. They rolled their eyes and kicked, reared, and pulled back against the ropes as though their lives depended on it. Who could tell them that this wasn't some awful precursor to death? What primordial fears of attacks by predators were provoked? Fear is in the horse's nature, and they were driven wild with it. They plunged back and forth and sideways on the ends of the ropes. Their necks and heads swelled up, and frequently they injured themselves. It was, and remains, a desperately cruel sight. This process is called sacking out. It continued for perhaps 4 days, its purpose to break the horse's willpower and thwart their capacity for resistance. In the next stage, a leg, usually the near hind, was tied up. Originally, to accommodate swords, riders mount and dismount on the horse's left, so the near side of a horse is the left side, the off side is the horse's right. A rope would be caught under their rear pastern and pulled tight to a collar placed around their necks. With the horses now disabled, a second period of sacking out further reduced their ability to resist. They struggled valiantly, heaving their weight pitifully on three legs and groaning in pain at the pressure on their halters. Each leg in turn was tied up. Sacking out now took less and less time to sap their spirit. Then with the hind leg again tied off, a saddle was fixed on. The horses renewed their resistance, fighting the girth. More sacking out wore them down. Some fought for many hours. Others gave up more quickly and descended into confusion, waiting for more pain. By now, 8 to 10 days had passed. The horses had blood tracks on their pasterns where the ropes had worn through the skin. In places, friction burned off the hair. Bruising and more serious leg injuries were common. The horses' relationship with their human masters was now defined. They would work out of fear, not willingness. To destroy the willingness in a horse is a crazy, unforgivable act. Inherent generosity is among the dominant characteristics of the horse, and if nurtured, can grow into the most rewarding aspect of their working lives. Of the horses I've been close to in my life, I've marveled most at their willingness to try for me over and over again. At this stage in the sacking out process, the six horses were untied one by one and fitted with a hackamore, a rawhide noseband without a bit. For a further week, the horses were long-lined. Essentially, lines are attached through the stirrups to the horse to get him used to the bit. The aim is to introduce the horse to the notion of brakes and gas pedal, ideas that don't come naturally to him. The rider to come will need the horse to know about stop and go. I have a dramatic black-and-white photograph of my father long-lining a horse in the corral. He's bent low, hinged forward at the waist, his whole body tensed and focused on the poor horse at the end of the two lines. One might think a charge of electricity runs along the lines between man and horse. The horse kicks up great clouds of dust and reels off the corral fence, the whites in his eyes showing. The horse desperately tries to escape my father, and one eye looks back at him in fear and dread. When my father came to ride these horses for the first time, their rear legs would be tied up again to prevent bucking. He mounted and dismounted, kicking them in the belly, tried any way he could to provoke some fight in them. If they moved, they were whipped. If convinced they were broken, he would untie them and ride them in the round pen. Those not ready to ride spent part of the day with their legs tied up, groaning in pain and despair. The whole process took a minimum of 3 weeks. Given those same 6 horses today, I'd have them ready to ride without tethering and whips and without inflicting a moment's discomfort. I'd communicate almost entirely with my body language, using my voice in only a minor way, and the result would be a willing partner that would try hard throughout his working life. All this, and all 6 horses in just 3 hours, not 3 weeks. My father was standing next to a stranger, beckoning me over to him. "Monty, this is Mr. Don Page." The man loomed above me, holding out his hand for me to shake. It was 1939, and I was 4 years old. I was in competition at the Pickwick Riding Stables in Burbank, California. This area was also home to many Hollywood movie studios such as MGM, Paramount, and Warner Brothers. My father continued, "Mr. Page works at Warner Brothers, Monty." They were both looking at me expectantly, and I waited to hear what was coming. Mr. Page dropped to his haunches to bring his face level with mine. "You know, horse stories are real popular at the moment. You seen any? Everyone's hungry for stories with kids and horses and nice things like that, so they can forget all the trouble we're in, what with the Depression and the war in Europe, and we haven't got enough kids who can ride for us." I squinted across at him and began to think I knew what he was after. "Your dad tells me you can ride pretty well. How do you feel about coming along to show us what you can do?" Mr. Page suggested we stay over for a day and visit a nearby location where the studio's stunt team kept their horses and perfected their routines. At the appointed time for my audition, we turned up at this studio facility and were greeted by a line of people, likely stunt directors and casting directors. They had a steady, predictable horse ready for me, one presumably accustomed to the peculiar demands of Hollywood film directors. He was a bay gelding and led the low life of a studio mount in those days when the film industry was not so concerned about the safety of animals. Someone called out, "Okay, Monty, just canter pass from left to right." I did. "And now back the other way, if possible." I successfully completed this difficult maneuver. Difficult, that is, for most 4-year-olds. "Now can you pull up to a dead stop and jump off?" This time he sounded more questioning. He was no longer issuing instructions. But I'd been jumping off horses for some time now. There was some whispering between my father and the line of studio observers. The man issuing all the orders came over to where I was standing by my horse. He looked at me and asked in a serious tone, "You see the sand pit over there?" I looked to where he was pointing. "If you're comfortable about it, could you just ride over the sand pit and sort of fall off while the horse is moving?" I cantered the gelding over to the sand pit and took a dive off the right-hand side. The sporadic outbreak of applause was no doubt led by my father. I stood up and brushed the sand off my clothes. Someone had caught the gelding and was bringing him back. Next, they had me doing all sorts of tricks. "Can you fall off the rear end? Could you just canter him past us and be invisible, hanging off the other side?" Like most kids, my brother and I watch motion pictures on Saturday mornings. We then go home and try to copy the stunts using a trick riding saddle our father had found for us. I left that studio facility pretty sore, but I had literally tumbled into the movie business. And over subsequent years, I would appear in 100 or so films. I doubled for Roddy McDowell many times. On one occasion, the crew was setting up the massive film camera they used in those days, pointing the wide-angle lens into the corral. We all gathered round. "Okay, Monty," said the director. "You rope the horse here in the paddock. The pretty little girl is watching you from over there, sitting on the fence. Got that?"
"Okay."
"The horse yanks you off your feet, but you cling to the end of the rope as though your life depends on it." He frowned. "Now don't forget to let the horse drag you around the paddock for quite a while, because we have to get coverage of that."
"No, I'll hang on to the rope until you tell me to stop."
This cheered him. "Great! And we'll cut the sequence back to back with Roddy bringing the girl here and then taking off with her afterwards. Go along to wardrobe now and they'll fit you out in the same clothes as Roddy's wearing." It was a simple requirement, although my father was shaking his head and telling the producers how dangerous this was going to be for his son, and suggesting that the fee should reflect the level of risk. I roped the horse and dug my heels in to make it seem like I was being pulled over by the horse. I bit the dust, literally, and was dragged along the ground as planned. Then came a shredding sound. The pants given me by the costume department were of a thin, crepe-like material. With this rough treatment, they had bottomed out, and my bottom was equally out for all to see. I got to my feet mortified. No one could help me out of that predicament quickly enough. There was some consternation among the crew and much running about. They needed more shots of me being dragged, so I was to carry on, but wearing my own jeans instead. No new clothes to match Roddy's could be found. They'd worry about the continuity problem later. But it seems they didn't worry much. In the finished movie, Roddy McDowell wears off-white pants one moment, then in the next a pair of jeans while he ropes a fairly wild-looking horse, and afterward he's back in his off-white pants again. I doubled for many child artists. I was Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet, though I never actually met her until much later in life. They simply gave me a wig and a horse, and I followed instructions. I was Mickey Rooney, Charlton Heston and Tab Hunter, and you can spot me if you look carefully in Thunderhead and My Friend Flicka and scores of other films. It was a good career for a boy just starting grade school, although my father made all the decisions in dealing with the studios. He negotiated and signed the contracts. He wasn't legally obliged to consult me or to inform me how much I had earned, nor were there laws governing the use of minors in film production. Provision for schooling, minimum wage, and safety rules didn't exist then. And today, the parents of such a child actor would have to follow certain ethical standards. As my filming schedule increased, my father often congratulated me on how well I was doing financially. He told me he was investing the money on my behalf, that it would be waiting for me when I was old enough to use it wisely. If I asked for some of it to buy a new saddle, for example, he'd shake his head. "Monty, I'm telling you, I'll keep the money for you." He stuck to his word. I never saw a penny. For a 7-year-old child, a horse auction is a heady atmosphere. The crush threatened to carry me away, and I had to keep my father in sight or lose him. There was much squealing and calling, the auctioneer hammering away in his high-octane sales patter, and the horses of every description were hurried into the ring to be put through their paces. We squeezed into a spot near ringside and watched the first few horses, my father impassive. Then a skittish chestnut filly listed in the auctioneer's program as 8 years old entered the ring. She was playing up and pushing her nose in the air, bothered by the halter rope and walking into the back of the man leading her as though she were only a 2-year-old. She was undoubtedly a horse with problems, and no one was interested. My father was. He raised his hand and bought her for peanuts. He signed the bill of sale and then took hold of my shoulder. "Monty, time to go to work. Follow me," he said. I thought, here we go again. I ran along behind as he scooted around to the stalls to find the chestnut filly he had just bought. Filly in hand, we hurried to a spot out of sight of the sales ring. On the way, my father had picked up lunge ropes, a saddle, bridle, and whip. He put on the saddle and bridle and attached the lunge ropes, then ran the filly around in a circle,
turning her in both directions for about 10 minutes before reining her in and removing the lunge ropes.
"Overfed and underused," he said, making a snap diagnosis of the animal's unsociable behavior. "Ride her hard for about an hour, then bring her down to a walk and cool her off. Have her take backward steps every quarter of an hour. Clean her up, and we'll put her back in the ring in 3 hours' time. We'll do the usual show."
For the next 3 hours, it was just me and the chestnut filly. My affinity with problem horses, or as I call them, remedial horses, dates from these early, rather dubious experiences with my father at the sales ring. Horses whose difficulties he thought stemmed from maltreatment by youthful riders, child-spoiled horses, he called them, came my way. He felt that I was the best person to ease the horse's transition to a regular rider. I took the chestnut filly and did as instructed. But every time I worked with such a horse, I also felt compelled to figure out for myself what was causing the behavioral problem. When my father returned, he watched as I rode the chestnut filly steadily in circles at walk, trot, and canter. Then I slipped off, ducked my head, and walked repeatedly underneath her belly.
"Okay," said my father. "Let's go."
Back in the sales ring, buyers looked on as I rode what appeared to be a well-broken, gentle animal and put her through some impressive maneuvers. I dismounted and walked back and forth underneath the horse's belly. Buyers pressed closer. They were impressed. The voice of the auctioneer quickened and rose a notch as the figure rose to twice, then three times what my father had paid earlier in the day. The auctioneer must have been aware of what my father was doing. There was nothing illegal about it, of course. But clearly the horse's problems had not been solved, only quickly masked over. However, the sheer range of horses I rode made it an experience hard to equal. In time, I developed the ability to read and understand problem horses quickly and accurately. By observing the horse's actions and reactions, I developed an inner ear. I believed the horses were telling me something, and most important, I learned, with rare exceptions, never to believe the people connected with the horse. The rider wasn't lying, simply not listening. Over the years, this came to be the cornerstone of my thinking, so much so that it became like a mantra, and one proven by experience to be true. A good trainer can hear a horse speak to him. A great trainer can hear him whisper. Early in 1942, the California sun was baking the dry earth as my father and I moved across the corral where he broke horses. He leaned against one of the six upright posts used to tether young horses. The posts were even taller and thinner than he was. He was coiling a rope neatly on the post, ready for the next poor animal who would dance on the end of it like a fish on a line.
"Maybe it's time," he said. "He learned how to break a horse."
I offered no reply, for I wanted no part of sacking out. The posts in the corral were like grim sentries guarding the reputation of this terrible procedure.
"There's nothing much you can't manage," my father told me, "despite you being only a kid."
We walked over to a nearby corral where my father pointed to two young horses.
"There, those two."
They seemed of a gentle enough disposition. Then we climbed the rail and got closer. The two young horses stirred and moved away quietly, but they were receptive to our voices. They had been handled before.
"We'll have to do the pair of them together, okay?"
"No," I wanted to reply. I wasn't ready to sack out and tie up a horse. I wanted to avoid it completely if I could. My father continued,
"I'll let you know when I've got the time to take you through it and instruct you."
I asked, "Can I have a few days?" He didn't sense my reluctance. To him, it would have been incomprehensible to want to break a horse in any other way.
"A few days for what?"
"You know, maybe get to know them a bit first."
"To get to know them?" he asked, mystified.
"Maybe."
"Well, okay, but don't go messing it up. Don't go trying any fancy business. A horse is a dangerous machine, and you'd be wise to remember that. You hurt them first, or they'll hurt you."
I took the horses to a distant round pen and simply familiarized myself with them. I was in no danger, Adults were working on their horses nearby and keeping an eye on me. I merely walked around the pen following the horses and trying to cajole them into letting me closer. It was all trial and error, but on the third day I was surprised to find that one of the horses was following me around. Where I went, so did this gelding. To my astonishment, I could stand on my tiptoes and push a saddle on his back. There seemed to be no rhyme or reason to it, but it happened. Wildly excited by what I had accomplished, I ran immediately to the house to tell my father. I asked him to come and watch. He reminded me what he had said about not messing around as he followed me to the pen. I couldn't judge his mood. Maybe he was reluctant to waste his time walking 200 yards for nothing. Perhaps he had sensed my disobedience already and was angry about it. When we arrived, he said nothing. He simply took up position on the viewing stand just above the fence and waited. I was confident as I brought the gelding into the round pen. The horse and I wandered here and there together. It was an odd sort of dance, with neither partner knowing what the moves were, but eventually I was standing next to him. Then, moving quietly and calmly, I reached up as high as I could and slid a saddle on his back. It was, for me, a magical experience. At this point, I looked up at my father, who was staring at me with his mouth open. I was uncertain how to read that look, but I was hoping it was astonishment and maybe pride at my accomplishing this after only 3 days. Slowly he stood up, still fixing me with this look that could have meant any number of things. "What the hell am I raising?" were the first words he uttered. As he jumped off the viewing platform, I saw that he had in hand a 4-foot stall chain. Such chains were often slung over the fences, and he may have gathered one up as he was watching me. He burst into the pen and grabbed me by one arm. "What am I raising?" he said again, as if I had done something evil. Perhaps he expected me to cleanse myself, to apologize for veering from his methods. Instead, I said, "You saw it work. I was right." Then he raised the stall chain and brought it down hard, again and again on my thighs and buttocks. I reeled with the shock of it, and the blood drained from my skull until I felt faint. I can still remember the iron grip of his left hand on my upper arm as he used his right hand to wield the chain. The beating seemed to continue for several minutes while I writhed in his grasp, my eyes closed, my spirit shattered. I was left in a pitiful, grieving state. He whipped horses into submission, and now he was giving me the same treatment, and I felt the same anger and sense of failure that the horse must have felt. A lesson in how not to win respect and allegiance. It only enforced a reluctant obedience, instilled fear, and left me with a lifelong sense of resentment. I was put in the hospital so my parents could call my injuries horse-related and to keep me from the glare of friends and relatives. The term child abuse and the will to deal with it in society were still many decades away. Large areas of my body were swollen, and I could neither walk nor stand. The beatings continued weekly for 3 more years before finally starting to taper off when I was 10. Only when I was 15 did they cease altogether. On 3 other occasions, injuries from beatings required medical attention. I'm sure the doctor knew, but nothing was said. Amid this blur of pain and disappointment, I learned a second lesson. I promised myself I'd never again show my father any part of my work in starting and developing young horses. 44 years would pass before I once more took him into my confidence. In 1986, just before he died at the age of 78, I'd invite him to take a position on the viewing deck of a round pen, but by then, everything had changed. Even him. Later that year, in September of 1942, a stranger appeared at the gates of the Salinas Rodeo and Competition Grounds. A man in a jacket and tie and carrying a briefcase was not a usual sight in Salinas. My father and mother greeted him, and they stood in a knot, talking. From a discreet distance, my brother and I watched as my father raised his hand and pointed in different directions. When they started to move off, we followed, poking our noses around the corners of barns to see where they were going next. We soon realized that this stocky stranger was visiting areas of the competition grounds not normally used. From time to time, he'd stride up and down the lengths of the barns, measuring off distances. He examined the perimeter fencing. More pointing, more note-taking. A month later, a letter arrived. My father read it aloud as we all listened. It has been confirmed that the competition grounds owned by the city of Salinas are to be requisitioned and used by the U.S. government as a Japanese-American internment camp. What was an internment camp? Pearl Harbor had brought America wholeheartedly into the war the previous year, but I had no idea what this meant. My father and mother explained it to us by turns. We were at war with Japan, so Japanese immigrants and their families were considered enemies of the state and were to be interned for the duration of the war. But these people were our friends and neighbors. Some had been living around here for as long as we could remember. We were confused and stunned. Uncomprehending, we asked, "Where will they all live?" "The government plans to house them in the box stalls." "In the box stalls? What about the horses?" My father was silent, looking again at the letter. Then he read out, "Other buildings will be constructed to provide communal facilities." My father folded the letter and explained that we were being asked to choose the lesser of two evils. We could reduce our riding school and horse training activities almost to zero if we wanted to stay living at the grounds. Or we could leave. This was a traumatic experience for us all. If we chose to stay in our house, we would be living under cramped conditions behind barbed wire fences, as though we too were prisoners. And whether we stayed or left, we would have to sell most of our horses. I remember the arguments going back and forth. The atmosphere in the house blackened. There was no option. We would leave. My life had come to an end. I couldn't sleep and cried through most nights. Many of my concerns were selfish, as those of a small child tend to be. I already believed I was to be a champion rider with a future in showing horses. Now all our horses and equipment were to be sold. Larry and I watched resentfully as an endless line of vehicles came and went. Some brought materials to convert box stalls into the most basic of living quarters and to erect makeshift communal facilities. Other trucks carted off our equipment and our horses. Many of the horses were sent to be slaughtered at the notorious Crow's Landing. I'd later go there myself dozens of times, and I remember once seeing men with their lunch boxes open on the carcasses of horses. All my life I have believed that the time of a horse's death is a sacred one. You tip your hat, you think about it. Crow's Landing was a horrible place, but that was the final destination of these truckloads of horses as they rolled out of the competition grounds in clouds of dust. Larry and I were beset with anguish. To help assuage our grief, our parents told us that horse meat was required for the war effort. All over the world, American soldiers not much older than ourselves were living in desperate conditions. The outcome of the fight against tyranny depended on keeping these young soldiers fit and well-fed. Horse meat would go toward saving their lives and winning the war. In truth, there was nowhere else for the horses to go. No one could afford to buy them or, with gas rationed, even transport them. On one of those trucks bound for Crow's Landing was my faithful red roan, Ginger. We moved to a small house in the center of Salinas. It had concrete curbs out front and was the only house I would ever live in with a number on the door. 347 Church Street. Dating from the 1920s, the clapboard house had three bedrooms and an elevated floor. You navigated a lot of porch before you finally arrived inside. In the backyard grew a large magnolia tree. Its blooms, though exquisite, made me sneeze. Living here on this city lot, with neighbors in every direction, was unlike anything I'd ever known. My mother tried to console me and always lavished affection on me. In one photograph, taken early in her marriage, she wears a suit with fur epaulets, and the ringlets in her hair spill in a coy sort of way from her elegant hat. She was the oldest of 8 children, born of the union of a Portuguese farmer and an English-Irish schoolteacher. Her family called her Flick because of the way she darted about. My mother was also a subservient soul who walked in my father's shadow. But later on she stood up to him many times and literally threw herself around me to protect me. We hadn't been in that clapboard house long when she picked up our large globe of the world, brought it to my room, and asked me to find Japan. I eventually did. Then she asked me to find America. Now, Monty, look at those two places. Japan is a collection of tiny islands. The United States is a massive country, isn't it? So you can understand why, in just a few months, the war will be over, and we can return to the competition grounds. It helped. But there was plenty of evidence to the contrary, and I began to doubt my mother. If the war was winding down, why were people putting stickers in their car windows asking, "Is this trip really necessary?" Meanwhile, my father was 34 years old and therefore not eligible for service in the armed forces. But when he was younger, he had policed the mountains on horseback for the Forest Service, riding a horse and carrying a badge and a gun. The shortage of young men and the fact that he had once been a forest ranger made him an ideal recruit for the Salinas Police Department. When the news came of his appointment, it seemed to me that we'd never get back to the competition grounds. But one thing prevented my life from straying too far from the course that I had so firmly fixed for it. My father managed to rent a small holding on the edge of town.